From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Monday, President Obama gave his first formal interview as Commander-in-Chief to the Dubai-based Al Jazeera competitor, Al Arabiya.
My job is to communicate the fact that the United States has a stake in the well-being of the Muslim world, that the language we use has to be language of respect.
In the 17-minute discussion, Obama also addressed the future of Israel and Palestine, a nuclear-armed Iran, and the demonization of America in the Middle East. Reactions reverberated around the world to the first presidential interview, but we were curious about the reaction of the interviewer, Al Arabiya's Washington bureau chief, Hisham Milham. He didn't know he'd be interviewing the president at 5 p.m. on Monday until 9 a.m. that morning. And when he found out, well, he felt kinda
lucky, ecstatic, exhilarated, under pressure.
Did you feel ready?
You're always ready, because I've been mentally ready for this since the moment he announced that he's going to address the Muslim world from the heart of a Muslim capital within the first 100 days. At that time, I began to mobilize my friends, people who knew him, worked with him, urging them, arm-twisting them, telling them to say, you know, good thing about me. But I never thought that he would give it to us that early. So on Monday, when someone from the National Security Council said, I'm going to either make your day or ruin your day. Don't tell this to anybody except your people in Dubai. The president would like to see you at 5 o'clock this afternoon. And I laughed. I said, we have a full schedule, but I think I can accommodate the president.
So you think it was the recommendations that did it? Certainly not just that.
Look, I landed the first interview with George Bush for an Arab network, so maybe it's bipartisan, I don't know. Maybe I'm too old and I'm known here, or maybe because they think that my channel is credible, or they think I am credible. I would like to think that, obviously.
So on Al Arabiya's website, it says the channel is broadcast to an estimated 130 million Arab-speaking people around the world. With that kind of reach, did you feel a particular kind of pressure to represent a wide variety of people and passions and political priorities?
Yes, I felt pressure. We are talking about the United States having serious problems in the Muslim world. You have two raging wars, costly, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. You have disillusionment on both sides. You have the legacy of the last 8 years, not to talk about the legacy of the last 60 years. And it is extremely important for me to ask the right questions. And it's extremely important for the president, I felt, for him to say the right things. There are lives at stakes here. We are not talking about something theoretical. So definitely, if you take your job seriously, when you're given a chance like that, there's something wrong with you if you don't feel a sense of anticipation and strain, really. And the reaction, I've never seen anything like it. It's kind of embarrassing because I was involved in it, and I don't want to sound too corny about this, but I expected there would be a positive reaction. I expected that we'd be quoted left and right, but I really did not expect that kind of an overwhelming, almost universal reaction.
What was the one thing that seemed to come up most often? What struck your viewers most?
His authenticity. Average Arabs and Muslims felt, even when they listened or watched the president speaking to them in Arabic translation, they felt that he has the honesty in his tone. And I think he clinched it when he said, I have some members of my family who are Muslims. And the way he approached the Muslim world, the language that he uses, is extremely aware of the meaning of words. And I think he was effective in reaching out and enforcing even the cynics in the Arab world and the Muslim world to listen to him.
So was it more a question of his demeanor than any policy statements he made?
Policy is framed with language. If you look carefully, if you parse his words when he talks about the war on terror, he doesn't talk about it in generalizations. He focuses essentially on the real enemy of the United States, which is Al-Qaeda organization and its affiliated groups. The problem with President Bush was that he would lump Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, all sorts of Islamist groups together. And he muddled the issue. Conceptually, he muddled the issue.
You know, it's funny, when we spoke to you back in 2005, you talked about the stunning irrelevance of Al-Hara, which was the Arabic language channel funded by the U.S. based in Virginia that's broadcast throughout the Middle East. part of the Bush administration's hearts and minds effort. And judging from what you said back then, when we talk about hearts and minds, you say no campaign will work unless it's actually backed by changes in policy, or at least policy that matches the positive rhetoric. You don't think that Obama can win this battle for hearts and minds with rhetoric, right? Not even if he does 100 interviews on Al Arabiya.
Images, perceptions are shaped by policies. There was a time when the United States was held in high esteem in the Arab and the Muslim world for a variety of reasons. One of them is America the Educator that built the American University in Beirut in 1865. Later on, the American University in Cairo. You have the America of President Wilson and his declarations about the people who were colonized by the Europeans. You have the America that opened up its shores to immigrants from what is today Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine. And then beyond that, the most important thing about America and the collective minds of Arabs and Muslims was this is the major Western power without a colonial legacy in the Middle East. That's why people looked up to the United States before. Perceptions change. They are not etched in stone. And that's the beauty of it. I think President Obama understands this. Images and perceptions are related to policy. But also, I would say, style and words do matter, but they do matter up to a certain point. Fundamentally, as the president himself, as President Obama said, judge me by my actions, don't judge me by my words.
Do you find it hard to be objective about Barack Obama?
Somewhat. When I covered him during the elections, of course, you try to be as dispassionate as possible. But I always remember what one of my favorite philosophers, Friedrich Nietzsche, said, you cannot be totally impartial in a world where you live in it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hisham Melham is the Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya.
Amid predictions of tough times ahead for Republican legislators, there's one radio giant who seems to be turning into the life of the party.
Coming up, the Democrats win if Rush Limbaugh becomes the de facto leader of the Republican Party.
Well, the most visible Republican in all this week has been Rush Limbaugh, interestingly enough.
Limbaugh seems to be making a play to be the real face of the Republican Party, I guess, in what he believes is an absence of others.
The party ain't over, says Limbaugh, not as long as he's around to play Twister with the Democrats.
We are being told that we have to hope he succeeds, that we have to bend over, grab the ankles, bend over forward, backward, whichever, because his father was black, because this is the first black president.
Last week, he was reportedly asked by what he called a major American print publication to explain in 400 words his hope for the Obama presidency. He couldn't resist.
I don't need 400 words. I need four. I hope he fails.
A week ago, the president decided to address the onslaught directly, reportedly telling GOP leaders that they should direct their attention to the problems at hand, that they, quote, can't just listen to Limbaugh and get things done. What are we to think when our president engages in a tit-for-tat with radio's star bloviator? Byron York, the White House correspondent for the National Review, is here to tell us. Byron, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So this all began when Rush Limbaugh said he hopes the president will fail. Mostly opposition voices wished best of luck to the president while expressing skepticism that the president's policies will succeed. Seldom does someone say, I actually hope he screws it all up.
Well, I think that he later clarified, saying that he hopes that Barack Obama fails to bring about a new era of liberal government. That President Obama tries to implement liberal policies, then Rush Limbaugh hopes he fails at it.
Now, Limbaugh may or may not be the de facto leader of the Republican Party, but we do know that he is very influential. Tell me about Phil Gingrey and Tom Price, two Republican congressmen, and what happened to them this week.
There was a story in the Politico that quoted Representative Tom Price, head of the Republican Study Group, which has actually come up with the Republican Alternative Plan for the stimulus, quoted him criticizing not only Limbaugh, but I believe Sean Hannity and Newt Gingrich as well. Article is published, gets a lot of attention. Rush Limbaugh actually responds to it on his radio program, whereupon Representative Price sends out frantic emails, his press secretary does, saying, wait a minute, Representative Price never said this, did not say it. And as it turned out, that Representative Phil Gingrey, another Republican, actually had said it, and Price was very, very eager to make sure that people knew that he, Representative Price, did not criticize Rush Limbaugh. As for Gingrich, who actually did, he had to issue a clarification, which most people are viewing as kind of an apology. So, you know, if you're a Republican congressman, what's in it for you by criticizing Limbaugh, especially when you're both pretty much on the same side on this rather major issue facing the Congress?
Do you think that Limbaugh is genuinely standing up for principles, or is he just up to his usual blowhard tricks of trying to get attention cast on himself?
I would bet the mortgage that Limbaugh genuinely believes in the conservative principles he talks about. He's talked about them for years and years and years, and if he could make a lot of money by playing Keith Olbermann, he wouldn't do it. He's a conservative. That said, he is an entertainer. He wants the highest ratings for his program, and he gets them. But, you know, I think that you should pay him the compliment of believing that he believes what he's saying.
Has President Obama made the mistake of turning Rush Limbaugh into a more important figure than he actually is?
I think it did elevate Limbaugh to a pretty high status in the debate. Obama, after all, is sitting there with congressional leaders. And Limbaugh is an extremely important, extremely influential voice in our political debate. But he's not the president of the United States. He doesn't control the executive branch. And I think it was probably ill-advised for Obama to mention him in that way.
So in the end, let's just say Limbaugh really is the de facto leader of the Republican Party. Speaking as a radio host myself, although obviously one of teensy-weensy stature next to this guy, is that a good thing?
This idea, which has some merit to it, I think, that he is at this moment the de facto leader of the Republican opposition is a product of the mess that Republicans are in right now. The fact is, Republicans have lost big in 2006 and in 2008, and they don't have a leader right now, and they don't have a leader who's on the horizon. So I think that does give Limbaugh's ideas and his forum, his platform, his millions and millions of listeners, greater sway inside the Republican Party and inside the political debate as a whole.
Byron, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Byron York is the White House correspondent for National Review and author of The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy.
Coming up, the gray lady is down on her luck, and the French president is giving newspaper subscriptions as birthday gifts.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This week, the New York Times announced its fourth quarter earnings, a decline in profits of 48%. The Times' money woes highlight its position as a newspaper trailblazer, both in the quality of its reporting and as harbinger of the industry's financial future. After all, if the family-owned paper of record can't stay afloat, who can? Wall Street Journal reporter Matthew Karnichnig has been following the Times' money trail of tears. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I think it's fair to say the Times is in a fix.
Well, over the next couple of years, they have about $1.1 billion in debt that they're going to have to repay. They have $400 million that's coming due in May, and then they have another $250 million in 2010. But I think the real issue here is that it's very difficult for them to borrow more money because of the global financial crisis and the fact that their business is performing so poorly right now. They have a junk bond credit rating. Few people are going to want to give them money without a huge interest payment in return.
Now, as of last week, the paper announced that it had struck a tentative deal for something called a sale leaseback of their headquarters. It's a year-old building they just moved into on 42nd Street. That is a real asset. But what's a sale leaseback?
Well, what that basically means is that they sell a portion of the building to an investor, and then they lease that back from the investor, and they continue to occupy the building. It's somewhat similar to taking out a second mortgage on your home or something like that. But if you're doing it in an environment like this, you're not going to get as much money for it than if you were to do it when housing prices, or in this case, commercial real estate, was much more valuable.
So far, there are only a few visible signs that the Times is suffering. There's the banner ad on the front page, and there's the consolidation of a couple of sections, and the elimination of its sports magazine, Play. What do you think readers may see in the future if things continue to get worse?
What I'm hearing is going to be inevitable if the economy doesn't improve and if the advertising market doesn't improve over the next couple of quarters, which few people think will happen, is that they're going to have to start cutting into the core of the paper, really, meaning reporters and editors. They have a very large newsroom staff still compared to a lot of other newspapers. I was told this week, for example, that they still have people transcribing the evening news broadcasts, which might seem like an anachronism and something that might not affect the quality of their journalism. To the family's credit and to the company's credit, they've done all of these other things first. They've cut the dividend and they've borrowed more money, but it seems inevitable that they're going to have to take more drastic measures in the months ahead.
So for the average reader, do tough times augur no more book review?
All you have to do is open it and see that there are no ads in it. So it already is something of a public service that they're providing with that. And we don't really know which of the sections are making money and which aren't.
You know, it's become something of a parlor game for media watchers to figure out what it would take for the extended family of the Salzburgers who control the Times to sell their special shares of the trust. You've seen this process at work firsthand at the Wall Street Journal. Do you have any insight into what it might take for the Times' family to succumb?
Well, the Salzburgers, they control the company through these super voting shares, but they really aren't a majority shareholder in the sense that they own a majority of the equity in the company. I think their overall stake is around 20%, actually. They have to also think about the other shareholders in the company and what's best for them. And if somebody were to come along and offer a 50% premium or a 75% premium to where the stock is now trading, I think it would be very difficult for them to say no, especially if it were somebody like a Michael Bloomberg or a Warren Buffett or somebody of that stature where they could say, well, we're leaving the paper in good hands. This is a public trust and we're passing it on to somebody who we really think is going to take care of it.
The Times does seem to have taken one step in the direction of the tycoon model in striking a deal with a Mexican telecom mogul named Carlos Slim Helú.
Well, Mr. Slim has agreed to give the Times $250 million in return for a 14% interest rate that they're going to pay him back over the next several years. The big question about this deal is, why is Mr. Slim lending them the money, and is he really interested in playing a more active role in the Times going ahead? And I don't think that that's really clear at this point.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Matthew Karnichnik is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Andres Martinez is a fellow at the New American Foundation and a former editorial page editor at The New York Times and The Los Angeles Times. He's recently written in Slate about the mysterious Mr. Slim. Andres, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Exactly how rich is this guy?
Well, I don't know today exactly, given the vagaries in stock markets on both sides of the border. But Mr. Slim appeared out of nowhere on people's radar screens in late 2007 when Fortune and Forbes were proclaiming him the richest man on earth. And he pretty much has been neck and neck with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. You know, somebody teasingly calls Mexico Slimlandia. He was able to leverage his close friendship with former President Carlos Salinas de Gortari to take over Telmex, the state-owned telephone company. But he's in retail, infrastructure, insurance, banking, tobacco. His enterprises are across a slew of industries.
I think you noted in your article that one out of every $14 somebody in Mexico spends generally goes into his pocket.
That's right. And his enterprises control, it's estimated, 7% of Mexico's GDP and about a third of the value of the stock market in Mexico. John D. Rockefeller, in his heyday, might have controlled about 2% of GDP. So this is Bill Gates, Rockefeller, Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, all rolled into one.
You also write that despite his massive wealth, he's not known for having an outsized personality, and yet not so self-effacing that he hasn't policed his own public image from time to time. Tell me what happened to Denise Dresser.
Denise wrote a book that was a parody of Mexican history, not unlike John Stewart's book on American history, and it had some unkind references to Mr. Slim. Now, one of the stores that Mr. Slim owns, called Sanborns in Mexico, probably sells more books than any other store. And Denise was leaned upon to kind of reconsider the passages about Mr. Sleem. My understanding was that Sanborns had kind of hidden their copies of the book for a while. And there was then a very public outpouring and boycott of Sanborns until they started selling the book.
So now this staunch First Amendment advocate has become a huge individual lender to the New York Times to the tune of $250 million. Now, I think we know what the Times gets out of the deal, but you argue that what Sleem might get is gentler treatment from the Times editorial page, which we should stress is separate from its news pages. Do you really think that cash will buy him a pass?
You know, I don't think there is a media company in the United States with a greater sense of integrity than the New York Times. The problem that this creates is an appearance of a conflict. I don't think the New York Times would have struck a deal with a tycoon of a similar profile from Russia or, say, Israel or Iraq or many countries that matter more journalistically in the U.S. And in this sense, I feel, as somebody who grew up in Mexico, that our neighboring country is being treated with the soft bigotry of low expectations. But in the sense that, well, it's Mexico. We don't really need to worry about it. Who knows how people make money down there? And the fact that the New York Times is not covering the crony capitalism in Mexico, the inequality that feeds a lot of the social unrest. Every day that these stories are not covering the New York Times, from now on, the question is going to be, is Mr. Sleem's ownership stake in the New York Times a factor here?
Even if the Times doesn't cover the region that well, its coverage of the region is very important in the region.
For sure. The editorial page of the New York Times has called Mr. Sleem a robber baron prior to his first investment in the New York Times. And anytime there is an editorial in the New York Times or a big news story, that almost becomes news in and of itself. I mean, you have countries where people do not trust their local media. Very few Mexican publications are going to take on Mr. Sleem directly. Not because he necessarily owns the media companies, but because he is the largest advertiser. And it's not just about Mexico. Mr. Sleem's America Mobile cell phone company has businesses in more than a dozen Latin American countries. In Latin America, the perception will be this is now Mr. Sleem's newspaper.
You write that even if and when Sleem is inevitably criticized by the Times again, he'll win again. How so?
That's right. I think it's a win-win proposition for him. The greatest benefit for him is it legitimizes him. It gives him a good housekeeping seal of approval within Mexico. It's the same reason that foreign tycoons give to the Clinton Foundation, that they go to Davos. It's the same reason Andrew Carnegie built libraries. It diffuses any criticism within Mexico, because if the New York Times of any institution will partner up with Carlos Slim, he must be okay. And to the extent that there is negative coverage of him or the lack of any kind of antitrust regulation in Mexico going forward, he can then really brag about the fact that even this newspaper that he basically is in the process of saving can take shots at him.
And so what do you think that the careful reader, the lover of the New York Times, ought to keep an eye out for as this relationship with Mr. Sleem develops?
I think the test for the New York Times is going to be, as the situation in Mexico continues to deteriorate as a result of drug violence, but also as a result of this crony capitalism, is the New York Times going to continue to neglect that story? And to the extent that the New York Times editorializes against economic inequality in the U.S. or in other parts of the world and neglects the very same phenomenon in Mexico, that's going to raise troubling questions, because it really is a story about whether a weak state can rein in the likes of Carlos Slim.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Andres Martinez is a fellow at the New American Foundation and a former editorial page editor at the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times.
Last Friday, French President Nicolas Sarkozy announced an approximate $780 million aid package to help the country's ailing newspaper industry. He said it was the state's responsibility to ensure a free and independent press. Maybe, Critics say that Sarkozy may be angling to be the next Silvio Berlusconi, the Italian media mogul turned prime minister who kept an iron grip on his press. And a recent report for the Association of European Journalists claims that 57% of the French believe their media isn't independent, although for 18-year-olds it will be, literally, free. As part of Sarkozy's aid package, citizens will receive a free subscription to the newspaper of their choice on their 18th birthday. Angelique Chrysaphis, the Paris correspondent for The Guardian, says that these gift subscriptions are meant to hook young people on the printed word, although so far they've been able to resist the habit.
I think the president's idea is to ensnare young readers at a very early age and hope that they'll carry on, because, of course, the youth market is the hardest market to get at the moment.
The press has long been subsidized in France, no?
Well, yes. If you go back to the Second World War in France, obviously the country was occupied by the Nazis. And after the Second World War, about 90% of the newspapers were scrapped simply because they'd been seen to be collaborating. And what the state decided to do was just rebuild the whole newspaper industry. And so for the past 50 years, we've really seen a lot of state funding, direct and indirect, into the way papers are run, printed and distributed.
That said, if this new initiative takes place, the subsidy will increase like ninefold.
What the president wants is the press to modernize. The press in France has a lot of the same problems that we see in the US, that we see in Britain. Newspapers are in debt and ad revenues are in trouble. Now, the problem is specifically acute in France because, as well as those real major headaches for the press, you have a communist union totally in charge of the printing presses here, which means that producing a newspaper in France is about twice the cost as it is in Britain. So really, these are issues to do with printing and distribution, which are causing a real headache for the French press beyond the problem of falling readership.
But what then about the notion that a direct subsidy to newspapers creates a less than arm's length relationship between the state and the press?
There is a real issue at the moment in France with state intervention in the media. And it goes back to the fact that we have a lot of people in France, big business leaders who own newspapers. Now, those people, those media barons, happen to be very good friends with the president. We're talking about arms manufacturers. For example, Serge Dassault, who owns the Figaro, a big right-wing paper. There's also an arms manufacturing group, Lagardère, which has a big stake in Le Monde. There are construction groups which own private television. These are people that are so close to the president that some of them refer to him as my brother. Now, the question is, if you have people who are running your business that close to the president, are some of the journalists self-censoring because they think, I better not publish this story. The boss won't like it, therefore the president won't like it.
And in fact, that's not speculation. There was a gossipy little story around the time of the election, when Sarkozy, in fact, became president, that never showed up in the newspapers.
During the election campaign, Nicolas Sarkozy, of course, had a very tumultuous relationship with his wife, Cecilia Sarkozy. Now, at the time of the French election, some journalists discovered that Cecilia Sarkozy, the wife of the president, had simply not gone out to vote on the day of the election. This is quite easy to find because in France you have to sign your name on a register. So this was really big news because Sarkozy was trying to prove to the world that he was very happily married and then his wife wasn't even voting. Now, this story was supposed to go in the Sunday paper, the Journal du Dimanche, which is owned by Arnaud Lagardère, who, again, is an arms manufacturer very close to Nicolas Sarkozy. Now, the story didn't go in, but France has a very good range of websites at the moment, and they claim that they break news that the papers might be afraid to break, and they broke the story themselves.
Just so happens I had dinner last weekend with a French couple, and they were saying that in France, newspapers do not have nearly as developed an internet presence as they have here. Is that true?
Yes and no. I mean, let's not forget that France has the biggest blogosphere in Europe. French people absolutely love blogging. This is a country of political arguments, and that is very much going online. Now, newspapers, you could say, have been slower than British papers, for example, and probably American papers, in setting up their online presence. But that is starting to change.
So, like almost everywhere else, the media landscape is roiling in France. And apart from the problems with newspapers, there's a big controversy going on with state TV.
That's true. Basically, there's one big private channel in France. It's the most watched channel. And surprise, surprise, it's owned by the president's best friend. Now, apart from that, you have about four state TV channels. And Nicolas Sarkozy is causing huge controversy at the moment in France. And we've seen days on end of strikes by TV journalists where simply the news is not on air, for the reason being that he's changing the law so that he can directly appoint the head of state TV. And he's also decided to scrap advertising on state TV. What this will do is two things. It will mean that those television channels will be more dependent on the government, but it also means that all this advertising will have to go somewhere else, straight into the pockets of his friends in private TV. So, of course, unions here are very, very angry, and really there's a real mood on the media landscape in France that the president is taking much more of an interest than anyone else in 50 years in television and in the press, and that moves have to be made to make sure that he doesn't damage the independence of the media in this country.
Well, you got to hand it to him on one thing. Unlike Berlusconi, he doesn't actually own the private TV channel that the money will go flooding into, so that's something.
The Berlusconi comparison, of course, is very powerful in Europe because Berlusconi tends to be seen in Europe as a real laughingstock, but also dangerous, especially by people on the left. So the more comparisons to Berlusconi, the more annoying and worrying that is to people in France, I think.
Well, Angelique, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Angelique Chrysaphis is the Paris correspondent for The Guardian.
Coming up, life online and offline converge for America's younger generation and better living through cell phones in Japan.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Whether by cell phone, desktop, or laptop, there's a whole generation of children that has grown up connected to the Internet. An 18-year-old today was in diapers when the World Wide Web became a facet of everyday life. John Palfrey, director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, calls these kids digital natives and argues that they see the world very differently than the rest of us, those unfortunate digital immigrants. John joins me now. Hey, man, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so I spend my entire life online, and my daughters spend their entire lives online. What's the difference?
Young people don't distinguish, by and large, between the online and offline lives. They see life as converged in these two environments, where many of us see the world as divided between the online and the offline. I think this turns out to be a profound difference.
I mean, those of us in my generation, I'm about 1,000 years old, guard our privacy jealously and take care of how we parcel out information about ourselves. The digital natives seem much less scrupulous. I mean, judging from what I see on Facebook pages alone.
My co-author Urs Gasser and I, and when we were writing this book, Born Digital, thought about writing a myth-busting book to reinforce those things that were true and to break down those that were not. It turns out that privacy has a little bit of both. So it's quite right that some people do certainly share too much information about themselves online. They're going to have tattoos in the digital space that they want to get rid of a few decades from now. But for many kids, particularly the most sophisticated ones, they're figuring out how do you control that information better than many of us adults are.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about how prospective employers look at a MySpace page and see photographs of a very unfortunate party event and disqualify a candidate, you know, based on something he or she did maybe years earlier. Others suggest that in not too long a time, the employers are going to be digital natives themselves and be a lot more lenient about what tattoos may still show up.
On the one hand, it's absolutely the case that sometimes young people are putting up pictures of themselves scantily clad at a party on a social network that means they have a less good chance of getting certain jobs. On the other hand, I think we're absolutely going to see a world in which many more of us have much more information about us available on the web. And so what counts as a disqualifying factor in a job interview may no longer be the same bar.
I want to ask you about property rights. It seems to be one of the defining differences between digital natives and digital immigrants. I think what the file sharing services for music and even movies shows is that some people believe that if it's available, it's there for the taking. So what has to change? The mechanisms for protecting intellectual property or the worldview of an entire generation who thinks that all content wants to be free?
It turns out that in our research, the vast majority of young people do, in fact, get their music for free and often don't pay for it using a peer-to-peer service like LimeWire and so forth. It is no surprise that Tower Records has liquidated its stores. I think there are three ways that the situation can get resolved. The minds could change of this generation. The business model could change. I think iTunes was a major breakthrough in this regard. It has become the number one music retailer in the United States. I think the third option is you actually change the law. You find a different way to encourage people to pay for it, for instance, through their ISP bills or through their college tuitions.
Another big difference between me and my kids is what constitutes entertainment. I kind of like long form, and even when I'm looking at entertainment online, it tends to be long form variety. My kids can, you know, spend hours and hours scrolling through YouTube videos. What does that mean for Hollywood and for the broadcast networks and others who have been distributing highly produced long-form entertainment on the assumption that there will always be a market for it?
I don't think we've seen a major decline in young people spending time for a few hours looking at a movie, nor have we seen a major decline in young people spending a few hours doing gaming, for instance. So I actually don't think it's a huge attention deficit. It's more a format preference that they've been developing. It's harder to download an entire movie on the internet. That's getting less so with the advances of broadband. So I think it's entirely possible for Hollywood and others to adjust the format in which they're delivering the material. It may well be, as you suggest, that very large capital-intensive investments in large format things will be harder to recoup.
I've heard linguists discuss whether different languages, Western languages compared to, say, Mandarin or Japanese or Korean, involve actually processing the world in a fundamentally different way because pictographs require one way to interpret language and Latin letters another. Is it possible that digital natives are actually processing reality in a fundamentally different way than we immigrants?
Absolutely. Digital natives, those who were born after 1980, process information very differently than those who were not. And so I think that we are seeing a very long-term trend here in terms of how young people relate to one another, to institutions, and to information that is fundamentally different than what came before.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
John Palfrey is director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society and co-author of the book Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives.
Technology that has profoundly altered life for digital natives is the cell phone. Life without them is just about inconceivable, and if you think they do everything imaginable, a look towards Japan shows that they can do even more. We sent OTM producer Mark Phillips to take a look at one of the world's most cellular nations.
This is Akihabara, a neighborhood known as Electric Town, which for over 50 years has been the electronics capital of Tokyo, a city that's arguably the electronics capital of the world. The neighborhood looks like a techno nexus straight out of a Philip K. Dick novel, with huge neon signs covering pretty much every square inch of building. There are mind-blowingly loud arcades and electronic stores, big and small, stacked on top of each other, some even specializing in robots. But of all the electronic devices Japanese love, the cell phone seems to hold a special place in their hearts.
I can't do without my cell phone. It's probably the next most important thing to me after life itself.
This is Momoko, a young art student I met at a cozy cafe. And even if she's being a little dramatic, it's hard to overstate the importance of cell phones here. With a population of 127 million, Japan has 110 million cell phone subscriptions. Those numbers might be a little misleading, though, since many have two phones. Yata Suzuki, a middle-aged journalist, has three.
Yes, we are cell phone crazed. You can do everything with a Japanese cell phone. I can pay for my train ticket, get on a plane, I can read the news on the cell phone, I can mail using the phone, I can watch TV on the cell phone. They really do a wonderful job.
While the latest models in the U.S. can do some of these things, these features in Japan have been around for years, and they're used by Japanese young and old, tech geek and ordinary businessman alike. When I visited the country in 2002, the latest fad was the camera phone. It's now a standard feature in the U.S., of course, but way back in 2002, it seemed fantastically advanced. So can we look at cell phones in Japan as a harbinger of future mobile technology in the U.S.? Well, before we use Japan as a crystal ball, it's worth considering why Japan is so cell phone crazy in the first place. It's a small country with a densely packed population, which makes it easier to build a cellular network. But it's not just that.
There's also a difference in the way that fads and trends get disseminated among youth populations in particular.
Mizuko Ito is a cultural anthropologist at UC Irvine.
When you see a trend take off in children or youth culture, it tends to take off really, really rapidly.
And it's that Japanese youth culture that catalyzed the first eruption of mobile technology in the early 90s.
It was the first media tool, a personal kind of technology, that a young girl had ever owned herself.
Professor Daisuke Okabe teaches at Keio University outside of Tokyo.
The girls were able to decide on their own rules, manners, and methods with the pagers. For example, they could decide on how they wanted to express goodnight in numbers.
Goodnight, or Oyasumi, was 0833. It's a play on the pronunciation of the numbers, and they applied their code to other crucial phrases. I feel lonely was 3341. Kunikaza Amagasa is a graduate student now, but he fondly remembers those early days of mobile culture.
When a girl gave you her pager number in school, the idea of the pager itself made your heart beat faster, in addition to the fact that she actually gave you her number. So it was exciting in two ways.
Professor Daisuke Okabe.
These girls took the lead in creating this sort of culture. Then, companies who made these pagers developed products that actually allowed users to type the characters of the Japanese alphabet. Later, of course, that sort of function was incorporated into the cell phone as well.
And in many ways, typing remains the main function of the cell phone in Japan today.
I use it mostly for emails, then for internet. It's a cell phone, but I hardly ever use it for calls.
38-year-old Hiroyuki Saito, like most people I spoke to, prefers to communicate by email. Just take a train ride in Tokyo to see that. A crowded train like this one is perfectly silent, but dozens of men and women of all ages have a thumb racing across the keypad of their cell phone. It's considered extremely rude to talk on the phone while riding the train, but even when they're home alone, many still prefer an email over talking. Businessman Saito explains.
It's easier for me to say what I want on email. For example, when you need to ask them for a favor or when you're apologizing, it's easier to write I'm sorry or please in text.
It's worth noting that these are not text messages or SMS, which only allow 160 characters. Instead, Japanese cell phone email allows 10,000 characters. In fact, the word email means something very different in Japan than it does elsewhere. Satoshi Tanaka of DNA, a company that creates content and portal sites for cell phones, explains.
When you say email to today's young people, they would never think of emails you do on the computer. To them, cell phone emails are emails. There are even some users who would say, oh, I didn't know you could do email on a computer, too.
This brings up one of the biggest differences between U.S. and Japanese cell phone culture. While most Americans used computers to develop an intimacy with the internet, the Japanese accessed the internet primarily through the cell phone. UC Irvine's Mizuko Ito.
Broadband internet came in relatively late compared to, say, the U.S., and the mobile internet came in relatively quickly. You saw in the late 90s that people were really starting to orient towards the mobile phone as their primary portal to the internet, and this bias still persists today.
Many Japanese actually say they prefer the cell phone keypad over the computer keyboard because they can type faster on it. And perhaps most importantly, they don't have to share their phones with anyone else. That's why the pager fad exploded in the 90s, because it was so personal. DNA's Satoshi Tanaka.
With computers, although there may be one per household, it's unlikely that it would be your own. With cell phones, on the other hand, it would belong to you exclusively. Thus, you have the freedom to access anything, whenever you want.
This has produced two different trajectories for cell phone evolution. In the U.S., we've been upgrading our cell phones with the hope of recreating the internet experience we've had for years on the computer. In Japan, since the cell phone has traditionally been the gateway to the internet, the evolution has instead been the incremental improvement of the cell phone network and hardware. But even if our cell phones are on different paths, some of Japan's hardware features may start popping up in our phones soon. At any Tokyo train station, you'll see hundreds of people pass through the turnstiles in a given hour, and most just wave their wallet against a little sensor on the turnstile. A card in their wallet has a chip that tells the turnstile how much money they have in their transit account. Now that same chip is being built into the latest cell phone models. 50 million phones in Japan have already been manufactured with the chip. Grad student Kunikaza Amagasa has it on his.
It allows me to go out without carrying anything else. I can get around on the railway, and I can pay for purchases at convenience stores, since many convenience stores do it.
Even a sushi bar I went to had a scanner allowing customers to pay their bill with a swipe of the cell phone. And of all the cell phone adaptations, this one seems the most likely to go global. But perhaps more than any technological advances, Professor Mizuko Ito says Japan might offer us a look at the cultural impacts of widespread cell phone use, changing the very nature of news, entertainment, and games.
So, for example, in the past few years, you've seen the rise of the mobile phone novel as a new literary genre.
In the past few years, many young Japanese women began writing serialized novels with their phones. A young housewife who goes by Sakura Iro stumbled across a site that hosted such stories, and she started writing her own.
It's better than writing alone on a piece of paper. I could write like I was writing an email to a friend this way.
After she sent the first few chapters of her story from her phone to the website, Sakura Iro started receiving comments on her tale of heartache, bullying, and love.
I received so many, and since everybody was rooting for me, I felt as if I was making this together with everybody.
So she kept writing, and eventually her novel went viral, making its way to millions of cell phones. Later, a printed version of the book sold hundreds of thousands of copies. To Professor Ito, it's a natural outgrowth of a decade-old mobile phone culture.
You're seeing the first examples of media types that are native to the mobile internet, and I think it's a really interesting moment. So in the U.S., you know, it was about 10 years between the first personal homepages and the blog, where you saw a medium, a genre that was really native to internet culture. I think we're at that moment right now in Japan with the mobile internet.
Japan offers a glimpse of a society at the edge of total cell phone ubiquity. But everyone I talked to had something of a love-hate relationship with their mobile phone. Remember Momoko, who said the only thing more important than her cell phone was life itself? As our meal continued in the cafe, she revised her position.
Maybe I would be able to live without a cell phone.
Her friend Yui agreed.
Yeah, those times when my cell phone runs out of batteries and I'm not carrying a charger, I feel that maybe I can live without my cell phone after all.
They went on to lament the relentless interconnectedness that the cell phone facilitates and almost seemed nostalgic for the pre-cell phone days they never had the pleasure of experiencing. And Yata Suzuki, the guy who had three cell phones, he's even more critical.
Cell phones are driving people to the edge of nervous breakdowns. The reason why some people have multiple phones is that this way they can draw a line between the working life and the private life. They can use one phone for business up to, say, 6 o'clock. Then you turn that one off and you turn on another because you want to connect to your family. Actually, the ones who don't like cell phones usually have the most.
So of all the cell phone applications that Americans will someday enjoy, there's one old-fashioned feature that may become increasingly useful as we become increasingly connected. The off button. From Tokyo, for OTM, I'm Mark Phillips.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Dina Prechep, who is leaving us. Dina, thank you for all your help and good luck. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist-composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.